Do you want to have a humble share in perpetuating wisdom among men, in gathering up the inheritance of the ages, in formulating the rules of the mind for the present time, in discovering facts and causes, in turning men's wandering eyes towards first causes and their hearts towards supreme ends, in reviving, if necessary, some dying flame, in organizing the propaganda of truth and goodness? That is the lot reserved for you. It is surely worth a little extra sacrifice. It is worth steadily pursuing with jealous passion. Hello, my name is Ryan Hamill, and I am one of the hosts of New Humanists, the podcast of the Ancient Language Institute. I'm here with Jonathan Roberts, my co-host and co-founder of the Ancient Language Institute. We are on a quest to discover what a renewed humanism looks like for the modern world. Jonathan, thanks for joining me yet again. How are you?
I'm doing great. As you can see, enjoying my new comfy couch, my new comfy chair.
The Ancient Language Institute is real now. It exists. It has an office. And you are in it.
That's right. So this time you won't hear my baby playing with dinosaurs in the background, if that ever made it.
Yeah, it might have been audible in a couple of episodes. Well, today we're talking about chapters 1-3, the first third of the book, The Intellectual Life, Its Spirit, Conditions, Methods, by Antonin Gilbert Certiange, the French Dominican priest. We came upon this book kind of in a couple of ways. It's in the great tradition, Richard Gamble's anthology that we've been working through. And so for that reason, you are already familiar with it. Ansi Kamel over at the Davenant Institute, friend of the show, he really recommended it, talked about it on their podcast, Ad Fontes, which you should go check out. If for no other reason than to hear my voice some more, because I was a guest on there recently talking about ancient language learning. But he really recommended the book really highly. So I was listening to that at about the same time that our progression through the anthology reached a selection from Certiange. And so we decided to just read the whole book. And so Certiange was a Thomist. He was a teacher, very prolific writer, born in the 19th century, mid-19th century, died in the mid-20th century. So kind of his adult life was kind of taken up with the two world wars, to kind of give you a sense of where he stood in history. He's got a lot of stuff on kind of more technical philosophy and theology, but his most famous book is this one, which, what is it? What would you call this book? What is the genre, Jonathan?
It's kind of like a manual. It's like a how-to book. It sounds very lofty, right? The Intellectual Life, but it's actually also really practical. There's all these practical little things as to what you should do to cultivate the intellectual life. My favorite was the taking holidays. So yeah, sign me up for that.
Sign me up for the intellectual life. It's just reading on the beach.
Yeah. So yeah, it's a short little book. I think Emmanuel would be a good genre description of it.
Yeah, it combines both, you know, moving reflections on the nature of truth and reality with like self-help.
Yeah.
Stand up every 2 hours and take a deep breath. Open your windows and breathe the fresh air.
That's right.
Or as people on Twitter would say, touch grass. Go outside and touch the grass.
Yeah, he also talks about breathing exercises.
Yep.
Like just getting good oxygen into your system. Yeah, very practical and in a lot of ways very earthy, right? He hasn't put it this way, but the the classical ideal of mens sana in corpore sano is reflected here, definitely.
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll get into that. So this book starts with a discussion of the intellectual vocation, and then it goes on to talk about virtues, the virtues required for the intellectual life, and then how to organize your life. And that's where it starts getting really practical. So those are the first three chapters, which we're going to talk about. We're going to do three episodes on this book just because it's so rich. So the first, one of the first little nuggets of wisdom from chapter one on the intellectual vocation is that truth serves only its slaves.
Yeah, I thought that was a really interesting line there. I mean, there's a lot of kind of provocative lines that you'll see throughout the book. That one I found to be really interesting because the image that I have when I read this is, if you're going to acquire it, you actually need to work for it. It doesn't just come to you. And if you don't work for it to acquire it, you're going to acquire something. So if you want to acquire truth, then don't expect it to happen automatically. And so that you can think of that as potentially a cure for just being swept into some ideology that presents itself as like, this is true, but it's not. It gives you the appearance of it.
That's great. The connection of ideology to the desire not to work for knowledge. Sotianche says, to get something without paying for it is the universal desire. So obviously, you know, getting a Ferrari without paying for it is a pretty, you know, base level example of that phenomenon. But ideology, these kind of like total ideologies are the like philosophical equivalent, where I want to understand all of reality or as much of reality as I possibly can. You can do that through focused attention and concentration. And those are themes that Sotianche develops, the necessity for just training your attention to focus and giving it the fuel it needs and the direction it needs in order to bring you wisdom and bring you closer to the truth. Or, you know, the equivalent of walking into the dealership and just like smashing a window and going hot wiring the car and driving off the lot would be a kind of whole worldview or whole ideology that gives you a lens, not even a lens, but like a, you can press a button and it sorts everything. So, I mean, just the easiest example of this, I think, is Marxism. It says there's a structure and a superstructure.
Mm-hmm.
It's all determined by class and economic power relations. And that'll just kind of tell you how everything in the world works. But I think there's lots of examples of this kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. Here's an ism for you. And just master these simple principles. And now you've really understood. Now you've really taken the red pill and can now step out of the matrix, step out of the cave, when in reality it's just another shadow on the wall.
And I think the experience of pain is not an infallible guide, but is going to be some sort of guide to, or a clue as to whether you've deluded yourself to step outside the matrix and you think you're out seeing the sun, but you're really still in the cave or not, because there's going to be a lot of effort and pain involved in actually climbing out of the cave. If the experience of doing that feels like, I don't know, it's very gratifying to your ego. Oh, everyone's so dumb. Now I get it because I read this one book. You're probably on the wrong track.
Right. The way that he talks about it in terms of it being work, which is also how he begins discussing the intellectual vocation, right? He puts it under the genus of work. Everybody has work to do. And this book is about the work of the intellectual. But to your point, if you're actually doing work, like hard work, you feel it, right? If you're not working, if you're not working hard, you also feel it. And there's a difference.
Yeah.
There's a difference.
All that to say, you can't skip over in discerning, or I don't want to say acquiring a vocation, but discerning your vocation towards an intellectual life. We can't overlook the central role of pleasure. So yeah, we can talk a big game about, you know, difficulty and hard work, but it really starts with pleasure, is what Sotianche says. Pleasure and desire. He quotes the British statesman Disraeli, "You may do what you please, provided it really pleases you. It reminds me of a quote from Mother Teresa, people like kind of in anguish over the direction of their lives. What should I do? Is it okay to do this thing? All these kind of moral quandaries. And so we're going to ask Mother Teresa. She's going to tell us how to live, what to do, what's right and wrong. And she says, spend an hour and a half every day in adoration before the Blessed Sacrament, and then do whatever you want. So really kind of orient your life towards the supreme good, and then just do what you want, because your desire is actually not the worst guide, because your desire is there for a reason.
Yeah, well, the way that Augustine put it probably might also be helpful. Love God and do as you please.
Yes, yeah. So this illustrates a character of the Sertianj book that kind of runs through it. It's these two, he's always dealing with these pairs of opposites. So desire versus discipline, solitude versus society, liberty versus constraint, history versus eternity, the particular versus the universal. And then he's always trying to kind of present these opposites to you, and then pushing onto you the necessity of figuring out how to navigate between them. And in this way, he's just very clearly a good Thomist, a good Aristotelian, always kind of laying out the moral landscape of these two poles, but then putting on you the task of discerning the mean. And just a word about that. Initially, he says in the preface or foreword or whatever, that he set out to write a commentary on St. Thomas Aquinas's letter to Brother John on 16 precepts for study or something. Eventually, he realized this kind of narrow constraint of commentary on that letter, he realized was too narrow for what he wanted to do. But the book, he says, is still in the spirit of that. So always in the background is this letter from Thomas about how to kind of prepare yourself and how to live out an intellectual life. But desire versus discipline is one of these kind of pairs of opposites.
Yeah. So speaking of dichotomies, he brings up you mentioned solitude versus being in company.
Yeah.
So why is solitude important for the intellectual? What's the role of solitude?
Well, this is something he talks about later on, like chapter 3, I think, about silence also. There's a lot of stuff about silence. Yeah, I don't know. Do you have a particular part you're thinking about with solitude?
Yeah, I didn't mark the passage, but he seems to have this description of, like, you need to have some sort of silence or solitude in yourself that's constant if you want to be an intellectual. And
yeah,
it seems the idea there is you don't want to be like jarred around by noise and your own thinking. You want to be able to see something clearly, dispassionately, see it as it is, and internal noise is just not going to help you. It's going to hinder you and your pursuit of understanding whatever it is that you're trying to understand.
Yeah. He has what sounds like a manifesto against Twitter. He says, page 47, do not run after news that occupies the mind to no purpose. Do not busy yourself with the sayings and doings of the world, which seems like a description of that platform, which is ironic, though. It makes good sense, but it's also ironic because Twitter is more than any other platform and more than any other venue, period, is the meeting place for intellectuals, or at least in a broad sense, people who kind of make their living or their chief hobby or chief activity is discourse, generally, talking about ideas, about events, talking and having opinions and arguing. Twitter is where that happens. It used to happen in person in particular places. Now it happens more than anywhere else on that platform. And yet That, he says, is something that's going to sabotage your vocation as an intellectual.
Yeah, it's all the noise it creates. And then on the other hand, there's the need for being in communion and in community with other people. And he has this fun way of describing it. He says, or maybe not fun, but just rich way of describing it. He says, for you, an intellectual, your neighbor is the person who needs the truth, as the neighbor of the Good Samaritan was the wounded man by the wayside. So, you know, you need to be, the work of the intellectual is for the sake of other people. If, you know, the so-called intellectual is just in the, what do we call it, in the ivory tower and has no contact with regular human beings, then he cannot do the work.
Yeah, there's a definite earthy quality to all of these, you know, heady musings, where he ends up breaking down all these dichotomies that he establishes. He said they're kind of useful in the abstract to help you think about options, but at the end of the day, you don't actually have purely contemplative people and purely active people. One of his great lines is, he just has so many, he's kind of an aphoristic writer. Minds can only communicate through the body. Like, my mind cannot communicate to your mind, Jonathan, unless I'm using my hand to write something down, or I'm using my mouth to say something, and you can't receive it unless you are with your eyes reading what I've written, or with your ears hearing what I've said. And this is why there's all this kind of practical self-help stuff in the book, because your mind is embodied. You're a human. This is what it means to be a human, is your body is an inescapable part of who you are. And so you have to think about standing up every 2 hours and opening the window and, you know, going on walks.
Smelling the roses,
touching the grass.
Yeah, and so that is a recurring way in which he discusses stuff, you know, the dichotomies. And another thing that he's good at is that he never does the, and you will be an intellectual with one simple trick. I get a passage that illustrates that is in page 53 near the bottom. After that third section, it says, all our explanations so far show clearly that the solitude we have extolled is a value needing to be modified by related values, which complete it and turn it to account. So there are multiple, you know, he calls them values, multiple things that are valuable to the intellectual life. It's not like it's this one thing. If you can only have enough alone time, right? Or if you can only hang out with the right people who also love truth, it's just like making salsa. You need multiple ingredients cooked just the right way. And it's your job to do that.
Yeah. And not too long after that, in that same chapter 3, when he's talking about action versus contemplation, he says these are traditionally seen as opposites, and yeah, they are, but real life does not admit of such a strict separation. He says that thought and action have the same father, and so you can't strictly divide them, and solitude has to be completed, like you said, and so does everything else. He gives some interesting examples. The living composite grows tired of rest as well as of exertion. Or by carrying the cult of silence too far, one would reach the silence of death. So there's a way in which you need some element of social intercourse and speech and noise in order for silence to be silence. Otherwise, silence is just death. It's being entombed.
Yeah.
You need work and exertion and activity and exercise in order for rest to be rest, or otherwise rest is death. It's laying in a coffin, not moving. It's being entombed. And so there's a way in which the contemplative intellectual life tends toward death in a lot of ways. It looks dead. It's a guy sitting very still, not making any noise. And he's like, we can't be dead.
Right. Well, what I was thinking when I read this was, what a different world where he sees this danger of too much silence.
Yeah.
Right. Which, you know, it's not an unreal thing, but the circumstances now is like, who is tempted to have too much silence?
So let's talk about silence. I mean, we were kind of going we started with chapter one, but then we kind of jumped into chapter three. Yeah, go to page 48. That's really where he kicks off his discussion of silence. He talks about the nighttime and the desert. All great works were prepared in the desert, including the redemption of the world. And then the most exquisite songs in nature are heard at night. And that line set me in mind of my gap year. In between high school and college, I took a year off. And part of it I spent in France at the Tizé community, which is this funky ecumenical monastery / retreat center. All these young people all over Europe for the most part, but really all over the world, come and spend a week generally with the Brothers of Tizé, who are this monastic order founded by a Swiss reformed guy.
Oh, really? I did not know that.
Yeah. Yeah, Brother Roger. His dad was a Calvinist pastor in French Switzerland. And during World War II, in the Nazi occupation of France, you know, Roger is this young man full of piety and vitality. He's like, I can't sit here in neutral Switzerland and just hang out while all of this is going on. So he literally got on his bike and crossed the border into France. I think where he ended up was right on the border between the Nazi occupation and the Vichy government. So France was divided between what was like formally occupied by Germany and what was kind of run by the puppet government. So he was in the puppet government part, I think. And he just bought a house in the countryside. He's like, I don't know what I'm doing here, but I have to do something. I can't just be in Switzerland. And he just kind of created this life of prayer. And then other people started coming. They ended up harboring Jews secretly in their house, protecting them from the Nazis. And then the war ended. He eventually had to go back to Switzerland. He like returned to go do some fundraising, and then the Gestapo kind of found him out and wouldn't let him come back to France. So, but after the war, he came back at that house. And now, you know, decades later, there are like 100 brothers, this whole monastic order, and they get hundreds of thousands of people visiting them every year, mostly young people. And so I was there for a few months kind of helping with the brothers, because they have a little cadre of people that stay longer to kind of keep the place going. But I just have this memory, and I tell this long story. There's a point to it, multiple points. But I have this memory of being there. One of my jobs was being like kind of night security and walking around the village where the monastery was, and just saying, you know, you have all these people, thousands of people descending on this tiny French village, and you have to be careful about, because weird things happen. I mean, Brother Roger himself was killed at church. He was murdered. And so it can get a little dicey sometimes. But I just remember walking around in the middle of the night in this tiny village. There's no highway noise. There's no cars. It's just totally quiet. And just hearing the birds in the trees, the nightingales singing, it was beautiful, just absolutely beautiful. Like, these really are the most exquisite songs in nature. And I thought about Tizé because of that line, but also just because of this, what seems to me a very French tradition of thinking about silence and love for silence. You think about the great medieval monastic orders like the Carthusians, the Cistercians, and then the Trappists, who came out of the Cistercian movement, all started in Eastern France. Cluny the famous, like the biggest church in Christendom until St. Peter's, was at the center of this monastic, medieval monastic movement in France. It's just down this road from where Tizay is. Like Tizay, totally by accident, ended up at, like very close to Cluny. Bernard of Clairvaux. And then you have Tizay. And then you have, there's a great book that came out a few years ago by Robert Serra, Catholic cardinal from French Guinea. And he was converted by Holy Ghost Fathers, French missionary priests in Guinea. And he talks about the power of silence against the noise of the world. Sertiange, also, he's also French. And so there seems to be something characteristically French about just like really close attention to the power of silence. It's not a usual kind of stereotype of the French, but it really seems to be something they've kind of got the corner on.
Are there any kind of secular counterparts to this? So a lot of, you know, all the folks that you mentioned, there's a religious dimension, right, to their interest in silence.
Yeah.
I'm just curious as to whether that's made its way to the culture more broadly. Like if they're, I don't know, it'd be interesting to see if there are other reflections, you know, if secular French people of a certain stripe also have this value for silence.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting to look at the like Enlightenment guys, Rousseau, Voltaire, Diderot. They tend to, in a large part, those guys are reacting really ferociously against French monasticism. Like all of them pathologize it. So they write some really nasty things about this is I'm pulling back the curtain on what really happens in those monasteries. I mean, obviously there's humans are involved, so there's horrible things happening there. It's like anywhere, but you can't deny the power of these monastic movements in France that have been there for 1,000 years. But these guys are really hostile to it. Really lurid stories. They largely make up. I remember reading this stuff in French class. Diderot in particular is kind of gross. Like who's got the sick mind? is it these monastics or is it you, Diderot? But I don't know what they say about silence. I don't, or if they say anything.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because when I think of, you know, our situation, you can't even go to a library and then be silent.
Don't get me started on public libraries, man.
If anyone listening knows of a library that observes silence, send us a note. I want to know so that I too may go.
Yeah.
And yeah, so even the New York Public Library, which is pretty big, I found it hard to find like a quiet place there.
Interesting.
And even in little towns, like I live in a little town right now, library is not a quiet place. So now, like Ryan said, now that I have an office, this is a quiet place. I have not experienced this sort of possibility for silence in a long time. And one thing that not only are there not many places where you can, especially public places, where you can enjoy silence, but privately, I think we actively disallow it. So you think about how people study sometimes, like you're reading a book and listening to music. One of the best things that one of my undergraduate professors said was like, oh, and if you think you're going to study and listen to music at the same time, terrible idea, don't do it.
Interesting.
All right, here we go. no more music.
Yeah.
That's just like, let your brain do one thing.
I think it's painful to do that. And again, I think part of the reason people listen to music, I listen to music when I study. I remember doing it religiously with math. I really have a hard time reading with music, but math, I would do it. Maybe there's some reason or whatever, some study. But math is painful, at least for me. And the music acts as an anesthetic in some sense to the pain I experience doing calculus. It's been a long time. And going back to that issue of pain versus pleasure, is like, if you're an intellectual, you have to kind of chase down your desire, your real desire. You chase it down and be tenacious and take no half measures. So it's going to guide you into this place of pain, and you need to kind of accept the pain, because that's actually through that pain is where the real pleasure lies. You can sense it even if you don't have it all the way.
Yeah. Well, there's also this, we have this culture of where the enjoyment of pleasure is kind of passive. In other words, it's very consumptive, right? You know, watching films, listening to music, and we just need to be entertained all the time, all day, every day.
Yeah.
This is the all pervasive, you know, noise and music to just kind of fill, to make sure that there's no silence, to make sure that we're constantly entertained. And the sort of pleasure that would come with more sustained attention. So he talks about the importance of being able to work without interruptions. Imagine 2 hours a day. He this is the number that he uses, right? Imagine having 2 hours a day where you're not looking at a screen. You're not hearing any notifications from your phone. You're not hearing any music, and you're just reading, or you're just trying to understand a passage, meditating on a difficult work. I think initially for me, that would be draining. It would be kind of exhausting, because there's something, you know, when your mind is just doing one thing for 20 minutes and then another thing for 20 minutes, you're not doing anything for a sustained amount of time. When you switch from that to just doing one thing, initially, it's just going to feel like work. It's just work, and it is.
It'll be tiring.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like working out, right? But you can develop a habit, right? That you can start, you know, I'm just going to have total silence, no phones, 10 minutes a day. And then the next week, 11 minutes a day, you know, just claiming back some of that time and space. And I think that after going through a process like that, you would experience your, you know, 2 hours of silence in a totally different way and just be pleasurable. But it would be creative pleasure, or pleasure that requires work on your part.
What you said about it becoming pleasure just makes me think he paraphrases Thomas in his discussion of silence and says, pleasure fastens the soul to its object like a vice. And this goes all the way back to Plato. It rivets attention and liberates the acquisitive faculties, which sadness or boredom would constrain. And so the intellectual life is kind of discerned. The vocation is discerned in part by desire and pleasure, and then reinforced by it. You kind of chase down that desire, and you just go deeper into the desire. And it's the gradual and admittedly partial fulfillment of that desire that kind of rivets you and your soul to the pursuit of truth. The more you go after it, the more attached to it you become. And so we could just close up the discussion of silence just by talking about what it does, why he stresses it so much. He says that when silence takes possession of you, when far from the racket of the human highway, the sacred fire flames up in the stillness, when peace, which is the tranquility of order, puts order in your thoughts, feelings, investigations, you are in the supreme disposition for learning. What this does is solitude enables you to make contact with yourself, a necessity if you want to realize yourself, not to repeat like a parrot a few acquired formulas, but to be the prophet of the God within you who speaks a unique language to each man. And so there's this wonderful humanistic quality to what Sertiange is talking about. You know, there's a very lofty divine quality talks about how truth and goodness, when reached at the highest summit, are identical. And that if you pursue the intellectual life without reference to God, if you neglect the reading of the Bible and prayer in the name of chasing down truth and wisdom, you have, he doesn't say this exactly, but my gloss on it is like, that's idolatry. You want knowledge, you're just going for the created things. You, at the end of the day, you have to go for the uncreated. But at the same time, the intellectual life is about your vocation, you as an individual person, and you have to be silent, and you have to have some solitude in order to discover that and know who you are and what you're doing. Because your intellect, there's the intellectual life, but it's really, it takes place within you as your intellectual life. And you have to know who you are in order to pursue it properly.
Yeah. Well, moving on from silence then, there are two favorite passages. The first, one of my favorite passages is on 56, talking about friendship. He says, friendship is an obstetric art. And draws out.
So good.
What's that?
So good. Yeah. Sorry. Keep going.
Yeah. And draws out our richest and deepest resources. It unfolds the wings of our dreams and hidden indeterminate thoughts. It serves as a check on our judgments, tries out our new ideas, keeps up our ardor, and inflames our enthusiasm. And as our guest, Calvin Gallagher, says, this would not be New Humanist without a reference to the Inklings.
Oh, yeah, let's do it.
It's just hard not to think of those sorts of groups. The Inklings, or even some of the groups that Alan Jacobs talked about in his book that we discussed in our first podcast. You see really how friendship led to rich and productive intellectual and creative lives. It's what would be Tolkien without the Inklings?
Yeah, it makes me think of this line that friendship is an obstetric art. It's an art, in other words, of giving birth. And I hear that, I can't help but think of the Symposium and Diotima's speech in honor of in praise of love. She says that some people are pregnant in body while others are pregnant in soul, because there surely are those who are even more pregnant in their souls than in their bodies. And these are pregnant with what is fitting for a soul to bear and bring to birth. And what is fitting? Wisdom and the rest of virtue, which all poets beget, as well as all the craftsmen who are said to be creative. And then she talks in praise of politics. But Diotima says that everyone desires to be immortal, and the only way to do that is to give birth. And so you can give birth through your body, but you can also give birth to more noble things, more eternal things than other bodies. You give birth to ideas, which are eternal. And that's how you really get immortality. And so a man and a woman can give birth together, but to another body, and achieve some version of immortality that way. But two friends can give birth to an idea, and that can live forever. And so, yeah, friendship is an obstetric art, true friendship.
Yeah, it's kind of what I was trying to imagine is, or trying to think of examples of good intellectuals that have produced helpful work that did not have rich friendships. And I really couldn't think of anyone. It could be that there are examples out there, but none really come to mind.
Yeah, certainly examples of stormy friendships. I'm just thinking of Nietzsche and Wagner, because Nietzsche is kind of a loner, and he had a falling out with Wagner, but he worshipped him at one point. And I think it was their admiration was very mutual for a while. Yeah, Isaac Newton's kind of famously a loner. But yeah, I don't know the details enough. Yeah, it's a good point. We didn't talk too much about the virtues of a Catholic intellectual, which is chapter 2. Can someone who's not Catholic benefit, not a member of the Roman Catholic Church, benefit from this chapter, Jonathan? The virtues of a Catholic intellectual?
Yeah, I benefit from it, so.
All right. So don't be turned off. We're talking about God. We're talking about the Catholic intellectual, but I don't think it's some sort of exclusive thing. If you think you can get something from St. Thomas, you can. Then you can get something from this book. There's I think something we should talk a little bit about is the unity of life. Because this idea really undergirds a lot of what Sertianch is talking about, like this healthy mind and a healthy body. It's not just practical. It's not just kind of practically obvious, but it makes sense given reality, given the truth, because life itself is a unity. And so what does that mean? Sertianch says, it would be very surprising if we could give fullest play to one of life's functions while neglecting the other. Love is the beginning of everything in us, and that starting point, which is common to knowledge and practice, cannot fail to make the right paths of both, in a certain measure, interdependent. So they're not. So you talk about kind of physical life versus intellectual life. They're not the same, and they don't have the exact same fortunes. But because, you know, minds have to use bodies to communicate to each other, they're also not independent either. And so he talks a lot about virtue in this respect. And this idea of the unity of life ends up helping us retrieve a more classical conception of virtue. I mean, you say virtue, what do you think of? You might think of, like, you know, being a good person, being kind, or like Victorian virtue. It's like a woman's sexual innocence. But if you go back to Aristotle, what gets translated as virtue could also be translated as excellence. And so, or strength, like this, your physical strength is a virtue. It's a particular virtue, just like your courage is a virtue. Just like the theological virtues of faith, hope, and love are virtues. These are all excellences. And so all of the excellences support each other. They are in some measure interdependent. Some are more interdependent in particular ways than others, but none of them are totally, totally independent. And so what is the intellectual virtue par excellence? Studiousness. And he says that Sertianch says that Thomas places studiousness under the heading of the controlling virtue of temperance. And so if temperance, and in particular studiousness, is the golden mean relative to the intellectual life, what are the two vices on either side that you can tend towards? Negligence on the one hand and vain curiosity on the other. So we've talked about curiosity in the past on this podcast. You know, curiosity is kind of the intellectual virtue of kindergarten par excellence. You know, just be curious, just go explore stuff. I think there's some wisdom in there, in particular because just of the nature of how kids are. Like, little kids want to know the names of everything. They want to touch everything. And it's like, yeah, just like take all that stuff in like a sponge, but that's not the intellectual life really. And if you keep that up, if you keep acting like a kindergartner forever, which seems to be advocated by some people, where it's just like, I just want to, you know, major in this thing one day and major in another the other, you're never going to kind of dam up and canalize your desire, your intellectual desire that's at the root of your vocation in the proper way. Because you have to take this kind of expansive body of water, if that's this kind of hydraulic metaphor for desire. And you have to kind of narrow it into a river, which makes it powerful and rushing. And curiosity is just going to dissipate it everywhere. It's going to turn into a stagnant pond.
Right. Yeah. And of course, if you're negligent, you're just not doing the work.
Yep.
You're just letting it slide. And it's really interesting to think of, you know, the virtue par excellence is studiousness or the intellectual. But I suspect that when we, if we were to do a poll, one of those fun polls, you know, get a microphone and go ask people, what is the most important thing for an intellectual?
Oh, yeah.
I suspect that people would say something like genius, IQ, right?
Yeah.
Things that, you know, might be helpful instrumentally, but that's not what he argues to be the chief good, the chief excellence. We like this idea of something just happening naturally and being good at something naturally. So we like all the, we like the prodigies.
Yeah.
But, you know, most of us aren't prodigies. And but we're still built to achieve excellence. So how do we do that? Right? You can't just wait for like a stroke of genius to come to you and then you'll do the great thing.
Right.
Inspiration. That's also how we think of inspiration.
Well, he says that, I don't know if I have the quote exactly right. He says that studiousness or study feeds on facts. So on the one hand, he says facts and details are nothing. On the other hand, it's what the mind feeds on. This is kind of an interesting metaphor. You have to be grounded in the real and be taking it in all the time and consuming it. And this is in part why having a split life, I kind of feel this way. I spend most of my kind of working day, you know, what I'm not doing when I'm not, you know, taking care of my family and like cooking and eating and sleeping and kind of normal human stuff, I'm helping run Ancient Language Institute. And that's just like a lot of emailing and like looking at spreadsheets and boring stuff like that. But then I can carve out, you know, a couple hours. That's, he says 2 hours is all you need, 2 hours every day. So I can carve out 2 hours every day to do the intellectual life. But, you know, you can make that happen because ultimately you're just feeding on facts, on just what's out there, what is about, all about you. And so he repudiates Plato a little bit when he says this. He says kind of, Plato got this wrong, I'm on Aristotle's side. And so, you know, having a fairly active life isn't the worst thing because you're out in the world encountering real stuff. I don't know if sending emails really would count for him, but I do, you know, talk to a lot of people and people are real. People are facts. But you feed on the facts. But then in order to do what? He says, they're really nothing. Details are nothing. Facts are nothing. The important things are the dependences, the transmissions of influence, the connecting links, the exchanges. Science, scientia, is knowledge by causes. And behind all these dependences is the primal dependence. At the spot to which all connections converge is the supreme bond. And so, you know, there's the meme of, I think it's from some TV show. I don't know which show it is.
I'm sure I know it.
Yeah. Of, oh yeah, you definitely don't know the show. You haven't seen anything. but it's that kind of frantic looking guy who's like pointing at the wall. It has like all the papers on the wall with all the like strings connecting things.
Yeah. I do know the meme.
And that's kind of a picture, a kind of funny, crazy picture of what Sertian is talking about. This is real knowledge, is seeing all those connections. You can't get there without the facts, because you have to have pushpins. You have to have actual things on the wall. But just having the things on the wall, being an encyclopedia, isn't real knowledge. Real knowledge is understanding causes.
Yeah, he definitely wants to push towards kind of a metaphysical contemplation of things. Not merely, you know, categorizing this is a thing that exists, but what are the relationships between the things, and why do they matter?
Yes. And he has this great, great image of a tree. I can't find it. You can set a painter before a tree, and he can make sketches and paintings of that tree into all eternity, and he'll never exhaust the tree. Just the natural character of this tree. And he'll never think he has either. He'll be like, oh, I made one sketch. But you can always do something else. You can always go more. Whereas if you set someone before a painting of a tree, you know,
even a masterpiece, right?
Even a masterpiece, there's a pretty finite amount of time you can spend before that one masterpiece exploring it. The brush strokes of the painting, the colors. And I think someone could say, oh, well, what about, you know, you get into all the intellectual history and artistic history of the painting. It's like, well, then you've moved beyond the painting. You're now drawing connections and you're getting into the real thing of knowledge. But the painting itself, kind of knowledge of it comes to an end in a way that knowledge of something real, like a tree, does not.
Right.
And this is because the light, he says, the life of the real is not entirely in what we see, in what we can analyze by knowledge. The real has a hidden life like Jesus. And this life also is a life in God. And so on the one hand, you can't substitute your intellectual studies for contemplation of God. On the other hand, your intellectual studies, insofar as you are studying something real, you are studying God indirectly, because everything real has this hidden life in God. And so you are participating in a divine office, he says, through your studies. Don't forget that. One more thing I want to say, we need to wrap up. He says that you pay a luxury tax in the intellectual life because you have to simplify bodily pleasures in order to train your body to help your mind. And because minds can only communicate through the body, your body needs fresh air, exercise, good diet, etc. And it's this interesting take on the mortification of the flesh, which is what he's talking about, that you have to discipline your body and make it your slave, like Paul says. And it's not because the body's unnecessary, but it's actually because of the importance of your body. Your body needs to be healthy so you can go do the things you need to do. And that's why you mortify it. Because there's this kind of image of Christianity and the classical tradition as kind of being obsessed with the logos, obsessed with the abstract, and so kind of sneering at the body and having this kind of being kind of sickly. And Sertianos seems to offer a way out of that and to say both that the body is important, but also to reconcile that with the transitory nature of the body and the eternal nature of the soul, without denigrating the body. And I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. Well, my final thing that I want to share was my other favorite passage when he talks about children. I just thought,
oh yeah,
so great. So if we'll put the edition that we have on the notes, and it's on the last paragraph. On page 45, he says, children complicate life, but so sweetly that they should serve to give the worker fresh courage rather than to lessen his resources. The little ones take much of you, and what good would they be if they did not now and then tease and tax you?
Yeah.
But they hearten you just as much, and perhaps more. They can heighten your inspiration by mingling joy with it. They give you a love-lit reflection of nature and of man, and thus defend you against the abstract. They bring you back to the real, about which their questioning eyes are waiting for an exact commentary from you.
So good.
Their pure faces preach integrity, that sister of knowledge. And it's not their readiness to believe, to hope, to have great dreams, and to expect everything from the fatherhood that guides them. Does not this uplift you also, you man of thought, and give you a motive for hope? You can see an image of God and a sign of our immortal destiny in this image of the future.
Unless you become like a little child, you shall not inherit the kingdom.
The true intellectual must love the children.
That's right.
And must ultimately be at their service. So send that quote to every PhD candidate you know.
one final exhortation from Sertianos that really struck me, because I think he spoke to a lot of the vices that I have and that impede me. So one of these is kind of vain curiosity, being a dilettante, jumping from one thing to another. Another is being just kind of like a grouchy reactionary about everything. Like, everything older is better. I mean, we're the Ancient Language Institute, so we can be forgiven a bit of this. But it's not actually true that just because it's old, it's good. And he has a great line that it's like makes me want to get a tattoo of this. Let us not be like those people who always seem to be pallbearers at the funeral of the past. And we could talk a lot about that, but let's not. Let's wrap it up. Well, we'll be back with more on Sertiange. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed. If you did, please rate, review, subscribe, share with other people what you love about it. That's how the internet knows that people are listening and that the algorithms will show it to more people. We appreciate you guys. Thanks so much.